Welcome to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers with true crime masters and New York Times bestselling authors Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge. In this episode, we take you inside Casey Sherman's landmark reinvestigation of the infamous Boston Strangler case. And now, Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge.
The Boston Strangler case, considered the first serial murder case in American history, the first to capture the world's attention since Jack the Ripper prowled the streets and back alleys of London's Whitechapel in the late 1880s. But unlike the victims in the Ripper case, the women murdered at the hands of the Boston Strangler were not prostitutes. Instead, they were nurses, seamstresses, retired widows, and even students.
The city is for some glamorous, stimulating, prosperous. Only recently has it become dangerous. Five young girls have been strangled in the Boston area in little over a year.
The victims came from all walks of life, and that is what made this case even more frightening. No woman was considered safe. Every woman was a potential target. From June 1962 to January 1964, 11 women were strangled in the greater Boston area in a kill zone that stretched from the Tough City neighborhood of Dorchester, 40 miles north, to the Mill City of Lawrence. The victims were black and white. They were both young and old. The oldest was 75-year-old Ida Erga.
The youngest was my 19-year-old aunt, Mary Sullivan, who was fresh out of high school. Not only was she the youngest and final victim, but her murder was also the most gruesome. Mary Sullivan, a petite, raven-haired Irish beauty, had only recently moved to 44A Charles Street in the city's picturesque Beacon Hill neighborhood when on the bitterly cold evening of January 4th, 1964, her new roommates arrived home from work and discovered her lifeless body in a bedroom. At first, they thought she was sleeping. The women called out her name several times, until one of them summoned the courage to enter the room. She turned on the light switch and witnessed the horror. Mary had been propped up in a sitting position on the bed. Two scarves and a nylon stocking were wrapped tightly around her neck. The killer's bodily fluid was left dripping from her open mouth. Mary had also been sexually assaulted with a broomstick. The handle was protruding out of her body for all the world to see. Since the murder was committed on January 4th, the killer showed that he had a macabre sense of humor. He left a Happy New Year card placed by her left foot. Mary's parents, my grandparents, were notified of her death not by the Boston Police Department, but by a newspaper reporter who called their home on Cape Cod and asked my grandfather if he had a daughter named Mary Ellen Sullivan. "No, my daughter's name is Mary Ann Sullivan," my grandfather replied. He had forgotten that Mary had changed her middle name at Catholic confirmation. When he finally realized his mistake, his heart sank. "Is she in the hospital?" he asked. "No," the reporter replied. "She's in the morgue."
Imagine the sense of fear and the collective mindset of New Englanders caused by Mary's murder and the 10 previous killings. No one felt safe. Women purchased stray dogs from their local animal shelter, while others began to walk to and from work carrying switchblades in their purses. The public wanted these murders solved.
"Say, I'm a Christian, I believe in God, and I believe as long as I do what is right, I will be taken care of. But I do use all precautions that I can. That I'm not scared of the mad strangler, rather. I think of the tragedy of the lives that were taken, and I feel sorry for his soul, and I wish he would give himself up."
They wanted the killer off the streets. The city's newspaper editors had a field day with this story. It was as if Jack the Ripper had been resurrected to stalk the women of Boston. One victim would be discovered, and then another. Over a span of 2.5 years, 11 women in all would fall victim to the strangler. Yet, despite a list of possible suspects that had well over 3,000 names, police made no arrests in the case. In fact, no one would ever be charged with any of the Boston Strangler murders.
In November 1964, a Chelsea, Massachusetts handyman named Albert DeSalvo was arrested for a series of unrelated sex crimes. DeSalvo was a dangerous person. He was a sexual predator, a con man, and a thief. He had also acquired several nicknames during his criminal career. At first, detectives dubbed him the Measuring Man, as he often masqueraded as a modeling agency talent scout. Armed with a tape measure and an insatiable lust, DeSalvo groped several women while measuring them on the street. Police later called him the Green Man, as he would pass himself off as a maintenance man while wearing a green uniform to gain entrance to Boston area buildings where he committed numerous sexual assaults against women.
While being held on sex assault charges at a psychiatric facility in 1965, DeSalvo and his cellmate, convicted killer George Nassar, concocted a brilliant plan. They wanted to cash in on a $100,000 reward in the Strangler case. DeSalvo knew he was never getting out of prison. He had a family to support on the outside, so he decided that he would confess to being the notorious Boston Strangler. Nassar was being represented by a young F. Lee Bailey at the time. He told Bailey that DeSalvo was prepared to announce that he was the man police had long been searching for. Albert DeSalvo was ready to tell the world that he was the most notorious serial killer in American history. But the information would come at a price. DeSalvo wanted to collect the Strangler reward money, but he was also interested in selling his story to a publisher and a movie studio. In the era before the Son of Sam law went into effect, killers like DeSalvo could in fact profit from their murderous crimes. DeSalvo confessed to the 11 Strangler killings and added two more unsolved murders to the list. He was then put on trial, not for the Strangler homicides, but for a series of rapes he had committed as the Green Man. In the public's mind, the case of the Boston Strangler was solved. Or was it?
I didn't know my Aunt Mary. I was born 5 years after she'd been murdered. But I did know the giant hole that she had left in my family. Growing up in an Irish Catholic household, her death was never discussed in the open. I had heard whispers about the Boston Strangler in connection with Mary's murder, but didn't learn anything more about it until I saw the film The Boston Strangler, starring Henry Fonda and Tony Curtis, when I was a teenager.
This is the story of the self-confessed Boston Strangler, based on Gerald Frank's startling bestseller. It has been filmed where the actual happenings made shocking headlines around the world.
These things you see that come into your head and you don't have anything to do about it, now is the time for you to try to make some sense out of them. Face it, what did you see? Woman's breasts.
Whose?
I don't know. A blouse came off in my hand.
The movie was well made, and I thought I finally knew and understood what happened to Mary. So the next day, I brought the subject up to my mother for the first time. Mom, tell me about Mary. Mary just wasn't some crime statistic. She was my sister. She was my best friend. In a family of six children, my mother Diane and Mary were the closest in age and the closest in character. My mother was 17 years old when Mary was murdered. We had so many things we wanted to do, so many plans. That was all stolen from me. I tried to console her like any child would. I put my arms around her and I hugged her. "At least they got the guy," I said. "No," she replied sadly. "I don't think they ever did." My mother didn't have any facts to back up her beliefs. It was merely a sister's intuition. It was a bond between two sisters that could not be broken. That bond led me to journalism school at Boston University, and that bond put me where I am today. At first, I wanted to prove that my mother was wrong, that Albert DeSalvo was indeed the Boston Strangler. DeSalvo was murdered in prison in 1973, and at least would have some closure with that. But as I began to study this case, several questions emerged.
Were all the murders the bloody work of one man? First, there was no set profile for the victims. In fact, the methods used to kill each woman differed from case to case. Some victims were sexually assaulted while others were not. Some of the victims had been robbed while others were not. Indeed, all had been strangled, but even the technique used by the killer to tie the knots was dissimilar with each victim. In fact, Boston police detectives believed these murders were not the work of just one man.
The fact that some were strangled with silk stockings, some were strangled manually, and some strangled with ligature other than silk stocking tends to show that the acts or the crimes were committed by more than one person.
I then turned my attention to the self-confessed killer, Albert DeSalvo, who had recanted his confession twice during his incarceration. Was he capable of such violence? I asked that question to retired Boston police detective Jim Mellon, who was one of the elite members of the Boston Strangler Task Force.
Well, he just wasn't a strangler. He was shown pictures, he was fed information, and just not his character.
There was not a shred of physical evidence that ever tied him to the case, only his words. No one could corroborate or question DeSalvo's original claims because the actual confession tapes had gone missing from the law enforcement files. 60 hours of tapes vanished. They had been stolen by a small-town sheriff who had worked on the periphery of the case. One of the major problems with this case was the sad fact that some police officers had unlawfully taken evidence to keep as souvenirs in proof of their work on this historic investigation. I found this retired sheriff who believed that he could still sell the tapes for profit, and I convinced him to let me listen and re-record them. These missing tapes were considered to be the holy grail of the Boston Strangler case. I then put the recordings up to the autopsy reports in the 11 Boston Strangler murders. And the confessions simply did not match up. Albert DeSalvo was confessing to events that never happened. It was news that made headlines around the world.
Some new questions are being asked about an old murder mystery, one most thought was solved long ago. The case of the Boston Strangler. 40 years ago, he terrorized a city and mesmerized a nation.
For example, DeSalvo claimed that he had raped my Aunt Mary and left semen inside her body. This is a portion of the actual confession tape by Albert DeSalvo, where he also claimed to have placed a gag in her mouth. But DeSalvo's DNA was not found inside the body of Mary Sullivan, and no gag was found inside her mouth. DeSalvo also claimed that he had strangled Mary with his bare hands, pressing his thumbs against her Adam's apple. She was actually strangled with three ligatures. I examined her autopsy and compared it to DeSalvo's confession. He had claimed that he had murdered my Aunt Mary at 4 p.m. on January 4th, 1964. But when the medical examiner inspected her body at 7 p.m. that night, she was in full rigor mortis, which would have been impossible in the span of just 3.5 hours. The only substance in her stomach was coffee, also an indicator that she was murdered much earlier in the day.
There were similar glaring mistakes in Albert DeSalvo's confessions to all the murders. He'd even regurgitated incorrect information from newspaper reports of the crimes. In the answers he did get right, he was clearly led by his interrogator, John Bottomley, the head of the Boston Strangler Task Force. Before taking this prominent position, Bottomley had worked as a real estate lawyer. In fact, he had never set foot inside a criminal courtroom in his life. Now, here he was interrogating America's most wanted criminal. Former Boston Strangler Task Force member Jim Mellon believed that F. Lee Bailey was also a force for information his client gave in his confession.
He called an information brokerage. He was fed everything. Bailey was told everything to tell him.
I then tracked down DeSalvo's former prison psychiatrist, Dr. Ames Roby, who had treated DeSalvo while he was at Bridgewater State Hospital.
When I first heard about his confessions, my immediate reaction was, no way. Albert DeSalvo sort of desperately wanted to be famous, and he fantasized how much he wanted to be the strangler.
DeSalvo was also aided by his prison cellmate, George Nassar. Many investigators and prison psychiatrist Ames Roby believe that Nassar knew the grisly details of at least some of the murders because he had committed them.
Hey, Casey. Like our fans who tune in here on Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, we're all about truth. Working on our projects, I need a boost sometimes. I love my coffee, but I'm really loving these true lifestyle drinks.
Me too, Dave. There are 6 different flavors for every activity. They're gluten and GMO-free, organic, vegan, and there's no artificial sweeteners or additives. They're clean, and they contain all sorts of vitamins and nutrients, and they're damn tasty.
You know, True's founder, Jack McNamara, is a former pro hockey player, and he created True because he was looking for healthy energy drinks that wouldn't make you crash. I've been loving Energy, the Orange Mango Wake Up Blend, as well as Focus, the Apple Kiwi Brain Blend. Jack and his team have scientifically engineered some game-changing beverages, and I'm working several of them into my daily routine.
And I'm making them part of my lifestyle, too. True drinks for true crime fans. Go to drinktrue.com and use the code SAINTS to get 30% off your purchase. Now, back to Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers.
George was an extremely dangerous man. He and Albert talked together endlessly by the hour. If any other inmate came close, it was clear from the way George looked at him that if he didn't leave immediately, he might have an unfortunately fatal fall in the shower.
In fact, the only woman to survive a strangler attack was later brought to Bridgewater State Hospital and was asked to identify DeSalvo, whom she did not recognize. Instead, she pointed to Nassar as the man who had assaulted her. Nassar had lived within 2 miles of 3 of the strangler victims. When police raided his apartment, they found police uniforms and doctor's uniforms, uniforms that would have given him access to the victims' apartments. So what happened to DeSalvo? He spent the rest of his life in prison before he was murdered by another inmate in 1973. For several years, his notoriety had actually kept him alive behind bars. Despite having recanted his confession once before, DeSalvo had now grown to love his moniker, the Boston Strangler. He had designed and sold choker necklaces at the prison gift shop. He managed to record a song while in prison called Strangler in the Night. DeSalvo would recant his confession once more before his death. He told his family and Dr. Ames Roby that he would tell the real story of the Boston Strangler and that he was ready to provide names of those who had aided him.
He called me. He asked if I would like to come down Monday morning to hear the real story, which indeed I was interested in because I had never believed he was the strangler.
Albert DeSalvo, known as the Boston Strangler, was found stabbed to death today in his cell in the prison at Walpole, Massachusetts.
Was it just coincidence that it was only hours before he was going to reveal the, quote, real story? I don't think so.
Albert DeSalvo was stabbed to death in the prison infirmary. His killer had managed to get through 6 security checkpoints, stabbed DeSalvo 19 times in the heart, and slipped back into the prison's general population without being detected. No one was ever convicted of his murder, and many investigators believe that it was a paid hit to silence DeSalvo forever.
Later, I learned that DeSalvo's former cellmate George Nassar had been transferred to DeSalvo's prison wing shortly before the murder. I had theorized that Nassar had played some role in DeSalvo's murder in a successful attempt to keep him from exposing the full truth behind the Boston Strangler case. I had heard that Nassar was in the late stages of cancer, so I decided to write him hoping for a deathbed confession. I was surprised when he wrote back, and he asked me to visit him behind bars. I entered the prison and I was escorted to a small cubicle with two metal chairs and phones on either side of a reinforced glass partition. I stared through the glass and watched as the door opened electronically on the other side. There, I saw a tall, thin man with salt and pepper hair. It was George Nasser. His cheeks were hollow. The olive skin passed down through his Syrian lineage had turned a dull gray. His eyes, however, were exactly how I had remembered them from his mugshot taken decades before. They were lifeless. "I know what you're thinking," he smiled through rotted teeth. "You think you're looking at Hannibal Lecter, don't you?" "No. I'm just looking at a tired old man who'll die behind bars." He smiled at that, and we began to talk. The conversation lasted for an hour as he denied any involvement in the Strangler murders or the murder of Albert DeSalvo himself. After speaking with Nasser that day, I came away with a feeling that he had the blood of innocent women on his hands, but he did not murder my aunt. My only goal then, when I began this journey, was to find Mary's killer. And we had come a long way. I had the confession tapes, which were a major smoking gun in the case. I brought this information to then Massachusetts Attorney General Tom Riley, who had promised to examine the case thoroughly. Well, 3 months went by when I finally managed to get back in touch with Riley's office. I asked Riley's top assistant what they had planned to do with the case. "Nothing," he said. "All the evidence is gone." Now that was a bitter pill for my mother to swallow.
"They don't want to reopen the case," he said, "because they don't have enough evidence." And my total amazement is, where did the evidence go?
More than 200 items were taken from Mary Sullivan's apartment, and none were ever returned to her family. Faced with what seemed to be an impenetrable roadblock, Casey decided to reach out to George Washington University professor and forensic scientist James Starrs, who had performed a series of scientific re-examinations of high-profile cases, including the death of Jesse James.
I asked him whether one could find trace evidence of a killer on a victim's body almost 40 years after the crime. He said the chances were slim. I relayed that news to my mother, who was not discouraged, but instead saw a glimmer of hope. "We need to do this," she told me. "I believe Mary wants us to find her killer." Professor Starrs wanted this too.
"We're certainly trying to find either whether we can exclude Albert DeSalvo as the guilty person or include him."
At the same time as my work in this case grew, I grew worried about what I had just stumbled into. I began getting calls at home saying, "We know what route you take to work every day. Stay away from this case." Now, these calls weren't coming from the killers. Instead, they were coming from those who wanted to protect the past at all cost. I then reached out to Jim Mellon, the lead investigator in my aunt's murder, who was now retired, and I asked him why anyone would still care about this age-old murder case. "It's not about Albert DeSalvo," he told me. "It's about all the would-be DeSalvos. This is the biggest murder case in New England history. And if they got the wrong guy here, who's to say they didn't get the wrong guy in hundreds, thousands of similar cases where they made the suspect fit the crime? You've got your finger in the dike here. Folks are worried about what's on the other side of that wall." I figured that we needed to form a united front. So I reached out to the DeSalvo family, who had also questioned his guilt in this case. And together, we formed one of the most unlikely alliances in the history of American crime. I wanted authorities to determine exactly who murdered my aunt, and members of the DeSalvo family said they were willing to let the chips fall where they may. We were not chasing ghosts.
Boston police had strong suspects in at least six of the Strangler murders, including one victim found dead less than a mile from the famed Fenway Park. Her body had been discovered by her boss after she failed to show up for work. At first, police thought it was a robbery turned violent, but the only item taken from her apartment was a photo album, as there were pictures scattered around the floor. There was money left untouched on her dresser. When the autopsy was done, they found out she was 1 month pregnant at the time of her murder. They also found out that she was having an affair with her happily married boss.
The forensic team exhumed Albert DeSalvo's body for DNA testing from Puritan Lawn Cemetery in Peabody, Massachusetts. I actually had the opportunity to hold the skull of the self-confessed Boston Strangler in my hands. It was a surreal feeling. Was I holding the remains of one of the most notorious killers in modern history? More surreal, however, was what happened next. On October 13th, 2000, the forensic team also exhumed my aunt's remains for DNA testing. Gathered at St. Francis Cemetery in Centerville, Massachusetts, were Professor Starrs and his high-profile colleagues, Dr. Henry Lee and Dr. Michael Bodden, both from the O.J. Simpson trial. The group also included a criminologist, an anthropologist, a toxicologist, and a geophysicist. As the team began to dig, they were disturbed by the high water level at the Cape Cod Cemetery. Professor Starrs informed me that the roof of Mary's casket had caved in over the years and that her body was now lying in 6 inches of water. Hearing this, I thought all hope was lost. Yet they told me that the situation would actually help their efforts, as the water had worked to preserve Mary's remains instead of deteriorating them beyond recognition. Mary's face seemed remarkably preserved for a 36-year-old burial. Professor Starrs was surprised by what else they had found.
We found a head hair that, of course, should not be in the pubic hair of Mary Sullivan. And we have found a head hair in the mouth of Mary Sullivan. We have bone fragments. We have some tissue fragments.
Samples taken for lab testing included head hair, pubic hair, eyelashes, and fingernails. Her organs and brain were situated inside a bag placed inside her abdomen by the medical examiner and were also well preserved. Extensive DNA testing was done on all UV fluorescent material associated with Mary Sullivan's body. UV fluorescent material was found in 3 places, including both sections of her underwear and in her head hair. Repeated efforts to obtain DNA from her head hair were negative, which frustrated Professor Starrs and his team. But with the exhumation, the team made several major discoveries which directly contradicted DeSalvo's confession to Mary's murder, in which he claimed that he had strangled Mary with his thumbs pressed against her Adam's apple.
We did have an intact hyoid bone, and that intact hyoid bone became an important element, because one might expect to find in the kind of strangulation that occurred in her case that that hyoid bone would be broken, which it was not.
In fact, the hyoid bone was completely fused, pointing away from manual strangulation. Again, Mary Sullivan was strangled by 3 ligatures, not by someone's bare hands.
The forensic team kept working until they found UV fluorescent material on 2 sections of Mary's underwear. The material was entwined with her pubic hair. It generated 2 mitochondrial DNA sequences. The DNA was tested against a sample offered by my mother. It came back negative, so the DNA did not belong to Mary herself. The sequences were also brittle, bearing all the characteristics of semen, the killer's ultimate calling card. The DNA was compared to DeSalvo's genetic fingerprint from his exhumation, along with a sample from DeSalvo's younger brother, Richard. On December 6th, 2001, James Starrs and his team asked me to participate in a news conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., where they would reveal information about my aunt's murder that the entire world was waiting for. Starrs approached the microphone and stared directly at me. "We have found 2 mitochondrial DNA matches on the body of Mary Sullivan," he said. "Neither matched the victim, And most importantly, neither DNA sequence matched Albert Henry DeSalvo. The evidence quite clearly indicated that Albert DeSalvo was not the murderer. We now had the scientific evidence to support further examination of Mary's murder case, but the Attorney General refused to budge. I wondered about his reticence to investigate the case or help my family in any way. During this time, the Boston Archdiocese had come under fire for protecting generations of pedophile priests who'd been allowed to prey on thousands of children throughout New England. Was the Attorney General also trying to prevent the past of his own office from coming to light?
So who actually murdered Mary Sullivan? Investigators had identified a prime suspect in her case shortly after the crime. He was a college student who had been dating one of Mary's roommates. The girlfriend told police that her apartment key had disappeared from her keychain the night before Mary was killed, a night the roommate had spent with her boyfriend. The young man was brought in and given two polygraph tests, which he failed. The only witness to the crime identified him as the man she had seen inside the apartment around the approximate time that Mary was killed. But as investigators were building their case against him, they were suddenly told to stop. Authorities were going with Albert DeSalvo because he wouldn't just confess to only one murder. Instead, he would confess to them all.
Once Albert DeSalvo was publicly declared the Boston Strangler, the prime suspect in Mary's murder disappeared. He'd remain a mystery for the next 40 years until I decided to track him down and confront him once and for all.
Coming up in part two of The Boston Strangler, the hunt for the killer takes Casey Sherman to northern New England, where he comes face to face with the prime suspect in his aunt's murder, while startling new developments emerge back home. Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers is a joint production of Mudhouse Media and Fort Point Media. This episode is brought to you with thanks to our sponsor, Work Local in Marshfield, Massachusetts. Music in this episode was provided by Chris Spagone. You can reach Chris on Instagram at chrisellaneousart. For more on the Mudhouse Media Podcast Network, visit mudhousemedia.com. That's Mudhouse with two Ds. And for the latest updates on their podcast and all of the writing and film projects of Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge, please visit fortpointmedia.com.